This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm Marty Lasden, and on this edition, we consider the future of bad words. My guest is Benjamin Bergen. He's a cognitive scientist at the University of California in San Diego, and a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post, Psychology Today, and National Public Radio. He's also the author of a new book that's generating quite a bit of buzz. It's called What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. Professor Bergen, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
For the sake of this conversation, let's say I'm an English-speaking alien from another planet, and I'm asking you to explain to me, what is it that gives that F word so much more power than all of the other words that you earthlings use that describe exactly the same thing?
Well, a little bit of it might be the way that the word sounds. Mm-hmm. So when you look across the profane words of English, we have this general idea that there's something about having four letters that seems to make a difference. And it's actually true if you do the statistics. There are more four-letter words that are profane than you'd expect by chance. But that's not the real thing that's going on. What's actually going on is not how the word is spelled, but how it sounds. Profane words in English tend to be one syllable long, and that syllable tends to have a lot of consonants, both at the beginning and the end. And it's not just any consonants. They tend to be these hard stop consonants like p and t and k. And words that follow this particular pattern are far more likely to become profane than they would be by chance. So part of it is how the words sound. But again, that's not enough. Becoming profane is a social process. It's not a purely linguistic process. It's not merely where the word comes from, it's what we decide we think about the word and how it's used. When a generation of people starts using a word in a new way, let's say they take a name that's a nickname for Richard, and they start using it to describe to describe the male member. Well, that's a change that older generations may see as one that's unacceptable. And they may decide, well, that use of that word offends me. And so I'm going to engage in whatever sorts of social control I can to stop that word from being used in that way. I don't like that it makes me think about things that I don't want to think about in public.
I read somewhere that a couple of linguists have estimated that English-speaking people, have 800 expressions for sexual intercourse. It seems to me that that's way more words than the Eskimos have for snow. What does that say about us?
Well, it's definitely true that there are certain areas of human experience that we attend to most and that we want to have language to describe the most. And taboo concepts are among those. Right? It's no surprise that the things that we wall off inside of bedrooms in homes or bathrooms are exactly the things that we feel most strongly about. They are the things that are taboo, that are personal to us, and those things, as well as religious concepts and other social groups, these domains of human experience that contribute most heavily to our taboo vocabulary, of course, are topics of most intense interest.
Doesn't it strike you as odd that in a culture such as ours, which is so awash in erotic imagery, that so much of what we still consider to be profane still has so much to do with sex? Doesn't that strike you as a little odd?
It is, but it's changing. So if you look at survey data from, say, younger Americans, English speakers, say 35 and younger, what you find is that they don't find those sex-related terms to be anywhere near as profane, anywhere near as offensive, as a host of other words, words that are slurs, terms that are derogatory labels for people based on their ethnicity, race, sexual identity, sexual orientation. And these terms are actually judged to be far worse to use in public by younger Americans. And I think that it's at least in part because, exactly as you said, we are exposed on a near minute-by-minute basis to sex and to sexual language, and to these sex-related profane terms. And the consequence is that we become relatively inured to it. It doesn't really impact us as much
I'm just wondering how fluid our sense of obscenity is. I don't know. Are you a fan of Kurt Vonnegut by chance?
Of course.
He wrote a novel called Breakfast of Champions. And in that book, he describes a starving planet where the most popular pornography consists of very close, tight videos of people ecstatically chewing on food, which is a funny idea, right? But, you know, it kind of begs the question, you know, right now, I mean, today, you know, even with all our enlightened views on sex, close-up shots of people having sex is considered obscene. But let's say in the future, you know, global warming gets out of control. You know, will photographs of people rolling in snow drive us nuts? I mean, how fluid is that sense of what is and is not obscene?
I think it's very fluid from generation to generation. As our cultural values change, our beliefs about language will change too. I don't think it changes much within an individual over time. We are very much, and we know this for lots of things, religious beliefs, political beliefs, and definitely beliefs about language, we are very much a product of the moment at which we came of age. And, you know, try as I might to convince my mom that that sucks isn't profane nowadays, it still will be for her.
It sticks with you.
It does. And so the change happens as the generations progress.
Well, let's talk for a moment about the word cock, which I think is a word I can use. This is a bird, after all, which is not known for its migratory behavior, yet somehow was still able to travel so far south that it became a penis, and not just any old penis, but a penis with very nasty connotations. How exactly did that happen?
Right. It's a great question. So cock didn't start off, obviously, with this second meaning the male member. And in fact,
you can't even say penis, can you?
I can say penis.
Because you,
say you
penis? Keep saying male member.
Well, I'm a professor. This is what we do.
Okay,
you
know? Right.
So, yes, cock started off as a word that simply meant the rooster, right? It's the male
chicken.
Yeah,
the rooster.
And over the course of time, it developed the second meaning. And we're not exactly...
How?
Well, we're not exactly sure how. We know that many words move from the animal world to the human world.
Yes.
Sometimes it's sort of by this metaphor process. So someone who is strutting around might be described as rooster-like or as a cock. And we actually have this still in certain expressions. Cock of the walk, for example, or a cock and bull story. We use it in other expressions, right? It's not just simply referring to roosters. And so maybe it migrated to referring to people, to humans, particularly human males. And then we know that there are lots of words for human males that come to refer to distinguishing features of human males, like, for example, the penis there. You happy? And we see this with names. So the name Dick, for example. Actually, lots of names for men. Peter, they migrate towards genitalia. And so it's possible that it happened in that way. It's also possible that it happened via a sort of...
Wait a minute, go back a second.
Yeah.
So how did Dick become penis?
Dick probably through a different process, actually.
Okay.
Dick,
that had nothing to do with roosters.
No, it didn't.
Okay.
Dick, we think, gained a military usage where it referred to a whip, a riding crop. And in particular, you can see how the handle of a riding crop might look visually something similar to a penis. And so through a sort of a visual metaphor, maybe it gets extended that way. But that's possibly something that happened with cock, too, is that maybe there's something about roosters that looks vaguely phallic.
You know, it seems to me that, you know, to look at a rooster and see a penis, you have to be pretty high. But let's say you're right. Let's say that rough analogy was made. That still begs the question, you know, why not some other bird? You know, like, why not a duck?
Yeah.
You know, to me personally, a duck looks more like a penis than a rooster does. Plus, you know, duck does rhyme with,
sure.
You know what I mean? So is there any good reason why farmers today cannot refer to their cocks with a straight face while ducks continue to fly free?
You know, if we could solve the problem of predicting language change,
we
I don't know that we'd make much money actually, but we'd certainly sit in a better place in terms of how we understand how language has changed over history. We can determine patterns, so things like animal terms oftentimes become human terms. Human terms oftentimes come to refer to body parts, but. As for predicting exactly which one, we're still very much at a loss.
Well, let's do a word experiment right here.
Okay.
Let me look you straight in the eye and say, Professor, you are a duck sucker. How does that make you feel?
I don't feel terrible about it.
You don't?
I'll be honest.
So that's not going to work then as a swear word.
I don't know why not. Maybe because they kind of rhyme. You've got a little bit of, you know, rhyming definitely doesn't sound very profane. There's this really interesting fact.
Really? Right? That's interesting.
Yeah, well, so when you... when you look at which words for, say, body parts or bodily functions or sex are most likely to be profane and which ones are most likely to be kiddie language, you find that the kiddie language often has rhyming or repetition of syllables. So, you know, you talk with your toddler about going pee-pee and poo-poo, doo-doo and wee-wee and all sorts of repetitive language. Yeah, that rhyming business or that reduplication of the exact same syllable doesn't make things sound adult-like.
It makes it
sound childlike.
I can think of three swear words off the top of my head that rhyme with the F word.
Oh, they rhyme with it, but you don't stack them up.
Okay.
Right, you don't put them in order. So a duck sucker, is that what you call it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's not as offensive as, well, you know, there was an old
then
term.
I don't want to.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's an old term for a brown noser fart sucker. Now, fart used to be a really offensive word. You couldn't say fart on television, actually.
Yeah.
For quite a long time, through the 50s, I think, or maybe even the 60s, you couldn't say fart on television. It was a four-letter word. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a four-letter word. Now it's not as bad, but many centuries ago, a fart sucker was a brown noser for reasons that you can surely imagine, and that was a bad word. That was something that people...
I would bet that this is the first time at UCTV that the word fartsucker has been used on a program.
I would not take that bet.
Well, you say in your book, and you've already said here, that the emotional impact of words do weaken with use.
Yes.
Does that mean that you know, our filthiest words will, in the fullness of time, be rendered impotent?
Yes.
And is that a sad thing?
No, because the changes don't happen within the mind of an individual.
But you say it is sad. You wrote in your book, you say, as sad as it seems, those are your words, you said, as sad as it seems, the days of dick and cock as swear words are probably numbered. So how numbered do you think they are, and why would it be sad?
Well, I was being a little cheeky about the sadness of that. But it certainly is, they certainly are numbered. I mean, dick and cock don't even show up now on the lists of, say, even the 50 most profane words, according to younger Americans. They really are on their way out. And so where, you know, people weren't naming their kids dick anymore from the 60s to present, you could very easily see it come back. And I actually, when I talk to my undergrads, I find that they oftentimes know someone who goes by the name of Dick, just, again, to be sort of fun and counterculture. And I fully expect that to be back in vogue within the next 50 years. So those particular, what's sad about it, I guess, is that these are the terms that a particular generation used for impact, to be funny, to communicate their emotions, to evoke emotional responses in others. Of course, that's what we do with profanity, right? Those terms are like, an old Ford automobile, you know, that maybe you loved. You know, that truck was a great truck.
Yeah. So there's a nostalgia there.
There's a nostalgia for it, and there's a thing that it used to be able to do that it can't do anymore. You know, when all the cars are automated, you know, maybe we'll look back at our Honda Priuses and, you know, and think how great those times were that we got to drive those things. And I think it's similar with those words. There will be, as long as our culture continues to do what it does, which is to suppress particular types of language and decide that certain words are inappropriate for particular public context, then we will continue to have something that fills those voids.
What impact would you say Donald Trump has had on a certain word that rhymes with fussy?
That's not a word.
Right. I know. But the word I'm talking about used to be a cat. Well, it still is a cat. Then it became a vagina. And now, thanks to Donald Trump, it will forever be associated with the 2016 presidential election. But will that distinction impact how we treat that word going forward, do you think? And if so, how?
It's a funny thing, that particular word, if you look at surveys of young Americans, it was already before the 2016 election judged to be more offensive than the F word. So it's no surprise that, if you'll remember, in that very same bit of tape, he did use the F word. That wasn't the word that got all the attention, right? And for good reason. We find words like that particular word that starts with P and has five letters. We find words like that to be offensive not just because they relate to sexuality or body parts, but because of the work that they're used to do, right? In order to use that word, you are oftentimes referring to a person in terms of their body parts. You're using a body part to stand for an entire person. You're sort of, you're dehumanizing the person. And especially when there are power relationships that are asymmetrical between the person who's using the language and the person that they're referring to, people find that quite an aggressive use of language. And this is why, for example, there are words for body parts, well, we've been talking about them, words for the penis, that don't have anywhere near the same type of impact. That the reason that those terms for penises, for example, aren't judged to be that offensive is because the power dynamic doesn't exist there. The people who are using those words to describe the male member are not disempowering the people who are the possessors of the body parts.
Is there, would you say, still an F-bomb gap between men and women? As you know, the conventional wisdom has been for the longest time that men swear more than women and do so with more abandon and panache. Is that still the case or no longer the case, or was it ever the case?
Well, we think that that's true. Whenever you look at publicly available records.
You think men still swear more?
Yeah, just quantitatively. There is just more swearing by men.
And how do you measure that?
Well, I mean, let's say one way that I've done it is I've gone to publicly available news groups, say on Reddit or something like that, you know, sort of stuff that's on the internet, which you can just quantify. And so there are some places where people will self-identify as male or female, and you have to, of course, trust them. But yeah, you can just quantify swears per 1,000 words. And certainly people who identify as male use more profanity in public. But we have no measure of language in private because it's private. And I've been assured by some female friends that there's plenty of swearing among and by females in private. I haven't ever been privy to it.
Yeah.
But that's not a quantitative question that we can really answer, actually.
So what do you make of that gap?
Well, I think it has to do with a couple of things. You know, the reason that people use profanity differs by context and differs by what they're trying to do with the language. But oftentimes, it's used to express power. It's used to increase familiarity or sort of comfort in a group of friends. It can be used to seem funny. It can be used to evoke emotional responses or to express one's own emotional state. And some of those may be more associated with acceptable public performance by males than females. So men are oftentimes more likely to express anger publicly. They're more likely to try to assert power overtly in public just because of, I think, what we believe that men are supposed to be doing and what women are supposed to be doing in their public performance of gender. So I think it just comports a little bit more neatly with how we expect men and women to behave in public. I don't think it digs into some underlying difference in sort of comfort with language or adeptness with language, because of course we know that women are, on average, have higher verbal IQs than men do. So that's certainly not it.
So as a linguist, would you expect that as women become more powerful and more equal in society, they will swear more, and that in that sense it's something to be applauded and encouraged? Or do you worry that it's just women trying to imitate men and that is not the basis for any sensible sense of equality?
You could imagine it going either way. I mean, I could imagine that if women became quite powerful and if language norms between genders don't change much, that men would stop swearing so much in public. And in fact, that's kind of what you see in environments that, so you see a lot of swearing in business environments. I'm told this all the time. So journalism apparently is a very, very sweary occupation. I hear it from people who work on Wall Street. I hear it from people who work as auto mechanics. There are lots of places where there's a lot of swearing. But one thing that I've heard quite often is that as those As new people are introduced into those environments, particularly as they become more diverse, language changes, people start to censor themselves a little bit more. They professionalize a little bit in the sense that they start to, you know, be more considerate about the possible consequences of using a particular word in a particular context. And so it's possible that language will change in that direction, in fact.
There was a story that came out, I think I read it in the New York Times not too long ago, about the president of the Philippines, who was known to have a very foul mouth, but he made this promise to his people that he would never curse again. But then, according to subsequent reports, he was only able to keep that promise for one weekend. And by Monday, he was calling someone a son of a whore. Did you see that story?
Yes, I did. God told him that he shouldn't swear anymore. So that's why he heeded that advice. Yeah, it's hard to stop swearing if it's a habit.
Now, I notice on the very first page of your book, you admit that you have a pretty foul mouth. So how long do you think you could go without dropping an F-bomb?
Well, you know, it comes out in certain circumstances. It comes out around groups of friends. It comes out over drinks. It comes out, late at night when I'm complaining about the day with my wife. You know, those are the circumstances that it's sort of, that it feels most comfortable in.
Yeah.
I could avoid doing it if I needed to, I suppose.
You think you could?
I have pretty good inhibitory control, you know.
See, for me, I think it would be like a Tourette's thing. The more I tried to keep it in, the more likely it would come out at the worst possible time.
It's true. This is the nature of inhibition. The more concerned you are about keeping it in, the more you try to keep it under wraps, the harder it is to do. I don't know. I haven't done the experiment.
I read somewhere that the average English speaker utters 80 to 90 swear words a day. I mean, that seems like a lot. But does that sound like a reasonable estimate to you?
It sounds a little high to me.
Yeah.
Average, maybe. I bet the average gets pulled up because there are some people for whom it's every other word. Median, I bet, would be lower.
Yeah. Certainly, the words that upset people that cause the most harm are the words that are most closely associated with hate speech.
Correct.
But you know, it's interesting, and you talk about this, that one way that targeted groups tried to deal with this is to embrace those weaponized words as their own. And so we have a magazine now both by and for the Jewish community called Hebe. We have a feminist magazine called Bitch. And as far back as the mid-1960s, a black comedian named Dick Gregory wrote a memoir called Nigger. So if the object is to minimize the harm, is this, do you think, an effective strategy?
Demonstrably, it sometimes is and sometimes isn't. And if I could figure out what predicted its success, I wouldn't be rich. Again, there are lots of things I could come up with. But so those cases in point, slut walks is another example. Bitch, I don't think has been that effective, nor have these slut walks. Gay has been very successful, in fact. Gay has come completely all the way around, I think. The G of LGBTQ used to be an offensive term. In my childhood, if calling someone gay or something gay was quite derogatory.
And
now it is used as a positive term of identification. Queer is an example of that. We talked about the N-word. It's not been so successful.
Let's talk about that word for just a moment. It's a word, the word nigger is such an ugly word. And so it's easy to understand why a lot of people would rather see that word entirely expunged from our vocabulary rather than simply rendered harmless. But you're not a fan of word bans, are you?
Well, I think that the one thing we know is that if you ban a behavior, it makes it more powerful and more desirable.
Yeah.
And that's true with language, just like it's true with alcohol or marijuana or anything you want to ban. So I don't see a lot of efficacy to trying to curtail behavior that way. If we really want the words to not be used in those negative ways, we sort of have two solutions, right? One is this reappropriation. Take it over and just flood the linguistic marketplace with different positive uses of the word.
Do you think we should do that with the N-word?
Well, some people are trying to do that.
Do you think it, you know, is it going to be, because it's such an ugly word, has such an ugly history associated with it, your body language tells me you're doubtful.
It hasn't worked yet, right? Okay. So it has lived two lives for decades and decades, right? There is this word that's, this version that's kind of spelled with an A at the end instead of an ER at the end that is very commonly used in certain varieties of African-American English where it means basically just like guy, you know, fellow. It has a variety of uses there aside from those, and that has not taken away the sting from the other use over the course of decades. Now, if you were to do this progressively for 100 years, maybe. You know, maybe kids who grow up now wouldn't really see anything negative about it. Mm. I guess another way to think about it is there aren't really slurs for majority powerful groups, right? Honky isn't offensive at all. There aren't ways to be derogatory towards, say, affluent white males, really, that are really hurtful or harmful. No one's thinking like, well, why can't we ban these words? They just don't exist. What are we going to do with whitey? Do we need to reappropriate whitey? No, of course not, because the power structure doesn't lead to them being perceived as having the harm that they are.
Yeah.
The real solution is get rid of the power inequity, and then the words will lose their impact.
I just wonder, you know, when we attribute power to words, whether there's a certain amount of magical thinking that's going on. I mean, back in the Middle Ages, if someone upset me, I might recite an elaborate incantation against
right.
that person.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, if someone upsets me, I simply say F you. But is this all about attributing to words a certain kind of supernatural, magical power that words don't normally have?
Yeah, I mean, the only difference between the F word and Santa Claus is that kids are told at some point that Santa Claus isn't real. I mean, we learn throughout our childhood that they have this magical power.
Yes. So, right? So
we believe it.
So what does all of this tell us about the future of swearing? Let's say we make it to the 23rd century and we're zooming around in starships and uploading our minds into computers. Will people still be, I mean, I know the words will change, but will people still be kind of swearing at each other the way we do now? Or do you think that perhaps they'll come up with new and more compelling ways to both bond with and piss each other off?
Well, if past performance is any predictor of future results, then you'd have to guess that there's going to be something like it, regardless of which language it is that we speak, whether it's English or Chinese or Esperanto. There's going to be a long history of profanity in that language. I doubt that it will have been scrubbed entirely as a cultural belief because it is so pervasive across most of the majority cultures that are still around on Earth. I agree that the exact words will not be the same, but the topics are likely to be the same. They're likely to be drawn from those same core taboo dimensions of human experience. Now, maybe taboos will change. It's possible that as we start to participate more in space flight, that there will be all kinds of new things that are revealed to us as dimensions of our experience that we don't want to share with others. But those would be the most likely to be contributing vocabulary to the profane words of the future.
Professor, it was a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for the conversation.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.